The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 18th of May, 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Monocle's headquarters here in Zurich. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recommits to America's long-standing alliance with Israel.
There is no equivalence between a terrorist group indiscriminately firing rockets at civilians and a country defending its people from those attacks. So we call on Hamas and other groups in Gaza to end the rocket attacks immediately.
We'll ask what role the U.S. and Arab nations can play in brokering a lasting ceasefire between Israel's army and the Palestinian militants. Also ahead, an update on the Tokyo Games, and our design and architecture team will also have a preview of this year's Venice Biennale. And a bit later on, our Eurovision desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, looks ahead at the warbles in the semifinal. Faye.
Tyler, it's an exciting Eurovision year. The list of favorites change every day. We'll go through some of the entries and who is tipped to do well this year as well.
All that right here in The Briefing with me, Tyler Brulé. And good afternoon from a semi-sunny Zurich. The U.S. President Joe Biden has voiced his support for a ceasefire after 8 days of violence between Israel's armed forces and Palestinian militants in Gaza. Mr. Biden told Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the White House is working with Egypt and other countries in a bid to bring about a truce. But do the warring factions want one? Well, for more on that, I'm joined by Emily Isahau. He is Program Coordinator for Peace Mediation at ETH here in Zurich. And he's also, of course, a regular contributor to Monocle on Sunday. Good afternoon. Very good to see you.
Good to see you, Tyler.
On one side, of course, we're asking this question, do these factions want a ceasefire? Yesterday, of course, we also saw from southern Lebanon also rockets inbound as well. What's your take on it?
So I would perhaps start by taking a step back and then go deeper into the specific context of Israel and Palestine. And just by starting by looking at ceasefires more broadly and just making the point that they come in all shapes and forms. So not all ceasefires are created equal, and conflict parties engage in ceasefires for a number of reasons. And sometimes these reasons can be, in fact, to reduce the conflict, and sometimes, in fact, to exacerbate or fuel violent conflict. So on the positive side of ceasefires, again, in terms of general points, of course, they can mitigate humanitarian consequences and destruction of infrastructure, as we've seen in Gaza and elsewhere. And they can also create a more conducive environment for actual political substantive talks. But perhaps on the negative side, and this is something that we can unpack a bit more in detail, there are a few cautionary notes when it comes to ceasefires. So one is, all underlying problems in a conflict are not solved through ceasefires. So let's mitigate our expectations when it comes to the potential of ceasefires and say if a ceasefire was signed between Hamas and Israel tomorrow, it doesn't mean that the issues are solved. In fact, that could be only the start of real substantive political negotiations. And then secondly, a second cautionary note is that parties can also use ceasefires to regroup, take buy time, rearm, and improve their military position. And we've seen this in Colombia and elsewhere. So again, something to keep in mind. And thirdly, and this is where it gets to really the context of Israel-Palestine, is that ceasefires can also reduce the cost of war, which means in turn that it can lower some of the domestic and international pressure to actually reach a real political agreement. And this might be, from an Israeli perspective, the case that if a ceasefire was reached, once they've made enough damage in Gaza on Hamas's military capability, that then the status quo ante might in fact become bearable for them again. and no need to reach a more consensual political agreement.
If you're Mahmoud Abbas, president of Palestine, how are you feeling this morning when we listened at the top of the program to the clip from the U.S. Secretary of State Blinken, where he's, you know, on one side saying, look, at we're really sort of calling for this to be ratcheted down, but at the same time, Israel has a right to defend itself at the same time. You know, how would you interpret that if you're on the Palestinian side of the table? Because it's a little bit like, well, you know, you can still have your rocks, but you maybe don't throw them quite as hard.
Well, that's precisely it. And I guess if I were him, one, I would be very much concerned with inter-Palestinian disputes, and that would probably be my primary focus. But secondly, if the silver lining from his perspective would be perhaps to look at some of the shifts within the Democratic Party in the U.S., the U.S. being the main partner of Israel, and looking at, for instance, this letter signed by 28 Democratic senators on Sunday, led by John Ossoff and others, calling for an immediate ceasefire and for the U.S. to put more pressure on Israel, and then looking at an increasing number of Democratic congressmen and women calling for the U.S. to take a tougher stance and use its leverage vis-a-vis Israel.
How much of this, when we go back to the notion of ceasefire, is really around humanitarian grounds? Because obviously, calling for a ceasefire, having, of course, some type of resolution to something which, of course, has been not just long smoldering, but also long, certainly explosive for a considerable amount of time. How much of it is focused on this, and what we've seen a lot today, Emily, is around this notion of proportionality and of course, the strikes in Gaza, seen as really being heavy-handed when, of course, you look at inbound, quite crude rockets that have been coming in the direction of Israel, and of course, airstrikes, drone strikes, and other things that are being thrown at the Palestinians.
Exactly. And if I, not to make it too academic of a conversation, but I'll just point to a great article that actually came out last week by Valerie Seher, one of my colleagues from CSS, and Sinica Vukovic, on bargaining theory and how that relates to ceasefires. And they propose a very nice framework of three what they call bargaining contexts to make sense of how parties perceive the situation to be and whether they would be willing to move towards a ceasefire and a political solution. And I'll just run through them quickly and link them to Israel-Palestine. So one, the first context they call diminishing opponent, which means that leaders believe that a military solution yields a better outcome, so there's really no real incentive to join peace talks, and the focus is very much on fighting and kind of demolishing the other side. The second one is forcing concessions, and this is when leaders really already want a peace deal, but they're still ready to endure some cost of war, and they're really focused on increasing their bargaining power and in a way dealing a lot of damage to the other side, but still wanting a peace settlement. And then the third context that they propose is enabling agreement, which means that you really are in it in the last moments of the process, and you are ready to stop fighting and reach a peace deal. And having just listened to a spokesperson from the Israeli Defense Forces yesterday, I believe it was on BBC World Service, to say things that, you know, they really focusing on degrading underlying tunnels, dealing a huge blow to Hamas and their military capability. This would be a signal, and he also talked about a premature cessation of hostilities being too much of a victory for Hamas, and them wanting to kind of increase their power in the current setting before reaching a ceasefire deal, would imply that we're definitely not in this enabling agreement phase or context, but rather either in diminishing opponents, so the focus is really on damaging the other side and not even wanting a peace deal, or somewhere in the forcing concession, so they're wanting to increase their bargaining power, particularly on the Israeli side, before attempting to talk peace in a meaningful way.
How quickly do the neighbors, and I guess we have to look to Amman and to Cairo, do they want to, do they need to get a lid on this? Because we were just saying earlier, of course, we've seen failed rocket attacks from the south, fired from northern Lebanon. They didn't hit Israeli soil. Israel has retaliated, against North Lebanon. I mean, of course, this happens from time to time as well. How, I guess, what I'm getting at is, the potential for this to spill over, especially if you have the neighbors to the south also weighing in.
So it's definitely a risk, and without being an expert on the region, I would say absolutely. The neighboring countries are very much concerned, and you see this already within Israel, and like some of the previous unrests and crises in Israel-Palestine, this has very much been a regional effort within the country in terms of Palestinian uprising. And then, of course, more broadly, kind of from an Israeli perspective, they benefit from being able to conflate the Palestinian struggle for freedom and for self-determination with indiscriminate rock fire at residential neighborhoods with an Islamic ideology. And this is something, of course, the neighboring Arabic countries would not be in favor of either. So it's in their interest to solve this dispute as quickly as possible.
Emily Izzo, I'm going to have to leave it there. That was Emily Izzo, Program Director for Peace Mediation at ETH here in Zurich. Now time to head back to London. Tom Edwards is there with the news headlines.
Thank you very much, Tyler. Hong Kong's government has suspended operations at its representative office in Taiwan amid a diplomatic standoff. Tensions between the self-ruled island of Taiwan and Hong Kong's Beijing-backed government have escalated since pro-democracy protests erupted across the city in 2019. Here, the UK government is calling for people to accept COVID-19 vaccination as soon as they're offered. Ministers say those who remain unsure should look at the situation in the north of England, where most people in hospital with COVID were eligible for a jab but had not had one. Spain, France and Germany have committed to the development of an integrated combat air system. The announcement, which follows weeks of talks, will see the development of a next-generation fighter jet and drones, as well as a communications network with artificial intelligence capabilities. And cruise ships will be absent from Venice's waters when the Biennale kicks off on Saturday. However, they won't be gone for long because local officials want to allow the mega ships to enter the city's lagoon from next month. We'll have more on Venice a little later on in today's programme. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you in Zurich. Tyler?
Thanks, Tom Edwards. Quick question for you. Will there be artificial intelligence for newsreaders?
I think I definitely need some. But it can't replace a real human voice, can it, Tyler? It's irreplaceable, no?
It is, especially soft tones like those in Studio One in London. Our Tom Edwards, thanks very much for that. The president of World Athletics, Sebastian Coe, has said that he remains confident that the Tokyo Olympics can be held safely and securely despite mounting calls for the Games to be called off. Coe, who helped mastermind London's hugely successful Olympics almost a decade ago, added that he couldn't speculate on a scenario where the Tokyo Games would be cancelled. Well, for more on this ongoing saga, I am joined by our Asia editor and our Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson. Good evening.
Good evening there. Yeah, I think saga is the word. Very appropriate time.
It is. And we're not talking about a region in Japan, though. I actually wonder if the region of Saga is also part of that 80%, which is not pro games.
I mean, really, the numbers are so bad. You know, you have to feel a bit sort of in pain for all these athletes, the feeling that they're not wanted. But you're right. I mean, the last survey that the Asahi Shimbun did over the weekend was pretty depressing reading, I'm sure, for Sebastian Coe. Basically, 14% supported the Olympics and 83% said, please cancel or postpone. And apparently postponement's not really an option at the moment. So public support has all but dissipated, I think, at this point. And really, the feeling at the moment is, can we please focus on vaccination rollout?
Mm. And on that, and maybe these are, I guess, two sides to the story, that the Olympics are already going ahead. It's planned. Venues are built. Athletes are in place. IOC delegations are coming into the country. It is rolling ahead. June is almost upon us. It is rather late in the game. So is this other message, like, okay, Japanese government, there's really not a lot you can do about this now anyway. So, you know, work on the ramp up, and this is going, you know, going ahead, and it's a little bit of wasted national energy, not just upon the part of the Japanese population, but also Japanese industry and Japanese government as well. It's a bit of a distraction, as you said, at a time when they probably need to focus on jabs a bit more.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they've tried to sort of appease this anti-Olympic feeling. They said they're going to half the number of officials. Apparently, there were going to be 180,000. There are now going to be 90,000. This didn't really apparently work in appeasing the people who didn't want the Olympics anyway. But no, I think Suga's ratings are really dropping. Lowest they've been. They were, I think, at 30-odd% today. And really, a lot of that is down to how he's handled COVID and this vaccination rollout, which has just been amazingly slow. At the moment, they still only approve Pfizer, but it looks like Moderna will be approved. And I think they're going to rush through AstraZeneca because they've ordered all these doses. The next hurdle is getting people vaccinated. And that is proving a very slow process. They've started the reservation system for the pensioners. So there'll be these big vaccination centers in Tokyo and Osaka from next week. And apparently, you know, the first week was booked out in Osaka in 25 minutes. So people are keen to be vaccinated, actually. But it's whether they can get the numbers vaccinated. It looks like they're saying end of July for the over 65 population. But many prefectures are saying that's just not going to happen. So I don't even know about that at this point.
Finn, what's the core of the problem? As of course, a longtime Japanese observer, we hear a variety of things. Of course, there is, you know, some of it is just, you know, ineptitude and slowness on the part of course, the prefectures dealing with the government on a national level. So, you know, there's a variety of things that play. But also, as you said, you need the vaccines, and it seems that there is this drive also to have something which is homegrown. We've seen a lot of upstart and certainly some established players in the Japan pharma business trying to get something going. And we've also heard at the same time a lot of, you know, Japanese saying, well, you know, the Japanese are special, and we're not really convinced that these Western medicines, I'm not sure they want anything from China, are also going to work either. Is that part of what's slowing this process down?
Yeah, I mean, there are many factors, I would say. One of them has certainly been this law. I mean, it's, you know, it's a legal requirement that new vaccinations have to be tested in Japan before they're given to the general population. So everyone that's applying to, you know, have their vaccination used here is going through that process. Now, that has, of course, undoubtedly held things up. They're trying to speed up the process. You know, it took quite a long time for Pfizer to get its approval. But yeah, that's absolutely, you know, held things up. And Taro Kono, who's the man in charge of the vaccination rollout, who's been a bit vague about why things are so slow. That's one of his excuses, that they, you know, that Japan needs to speed up the approval. There are other reasons. It's actually getting the people who can administer these vaccinations. And at the moment, it was doctors, nurses only. Dentists were also, you know, allowed to do it, but only, you know, latterly. And I think that's a problem, getting people to actually administer the vaccines. You know, they had a problem with syringes, getting the right syringes. The system, when they launched this reservation system this week, immediately technical glitches, which is not very impressive for Japan, and problems there. So it seems at every stage they're trying to do things very methodically in that way that Japan is so good at. But this situation requires a bit more of a sort of piling through it. Let's just get this done. And that sense of urgency just hasn't happened. And Suga has stated, the prime minister has really staked his, is he going to be prime minister after September? We don't know. But he staked it all on getting this vaccination rollout speeded up. Now, at the moment, there's no sign of it. And obviously, as you're saying, the Olympics are around the corner, but it's all very difficult at the moment. A tough week for Suga, that's for sure.
Fiona Wilson, our bureau chief in Tokyo, also our Asia editor, of course, will be checking in with you a little bit more on this story as it continues to evolve. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Vas Narasimhan, MD, has been CEO of Novartis since 2018. Since taking that role, Dr. Narasimhan has led a strategic and cultural transformation to build a leading medicines company, globally powered by advanced therapy platforms and data science. Under his leadership, the company has completed over $70 billion in strategic transactions. During and after his medical studies, Dr. Narasimhan worked extensively on a range of public health issues in low- and middle-income countries, and he continues to champion global health priorities. Vas Narasimhan, can I ask you to share some of your management learnings for the year, if you like? Can you talk to us a bit about how to lean into culture and how to use technology for good?
Our culture, which we called inspired, curious, and unbossed, is really around empowering people And now more than ever, you cannot micromanage your way through a situation like this. And the more you try, the more you just exhaust your organization. Now, that takes a lot of self-reflection as leaders to take a step back and empower your people. But we've really tried to lean into a story where our managers create clarity on what's expected and let people get on with the work. Don't think that you're going to micromanage your way through a global crisis like this. And that, I think, has allowed us to have a high level of engagement in the organization, maintain that through the course of the year, and maintain, you know, a really, really high level of commitment. And then I think that the third big learning is we all have to learn how to leverage technology to keep ourselves engaged and keep the organization moving. I do country visits around the world. Last visit, I did a virtual visit with Japan. This week, I did a virtual session with 5,000 associates in our manufacturing sites in Slovenia. I did a virtual coffee with associates in Poland and Greece. And I've been trying to find ways to overcome the fact that things that I would used to do in person, I'm now going to use technology to do. It's not the same, doesn't have the same impact, but I think it can still create a sense of connection. And I think looking forward, now the opportunity is to combine in-person engagement and virtual engagement, and I hope to have a multiplier effect across the organization.
Vas Narasimhan, Novartis, Reimagining Medicine.
You're back with a briefing here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Burley. I'm very happy to say that Venice is just about to kick off, and I'm also about to send off our two trusty editors here. We've got Nolan Giles, of course, one of my desk mates. We've got a wall between us, but one of my desk mates, and of course, our senior editor, with, of course, an architecture design urbanism brief. And also Nick Moniz is here as well. Someone who also has a small passing interest on urbanism and all things design related. Nolan, you've already had the luxury of seemingly almost being in contact every single day with everyone at the Biennale, but you've also had a little bit of a mini preview. So why don't we just start off and give us a little bit of a look ahead. But maybe just before that, just tell us, you know, why is this important on the design calendar, on the calendar of just events that have we've been missing in general?
Well, firstly, it's hugely important for the architecture industry. Typically, in normal times, every architect from the world will try to make it to Venice at least once in the year to see this event, which does run across the whole year. But the opening weekend is always the time you want to be there, because that's when the conversations happen. That's when the curators who create these exhibitions and installations are all there. That's when the real action takes place. So this is happening on Saturday. We are getting down on Wednesday for the media preview. But like you said, we have been able to really spend a little bit of time in Venice already. We've been able to do photo shoots there. So we've seen what's happening on the ground, and it's looking very good. Basically, it was cancelled last year or postponed. This year, not one of the exhibitors has cancelled. So it's going to be a full lineup. Everyone's feeling positive. Tourists are allowed to go to Italy now. So, yeah. Looking good.
We should also add this two very important points to this as well. There's a newspaper, Nick Moniz, which has to get out the door as well. This is the return of Monocle's newspapers, which is great. Hopefully there'll be one also for the Salone. There's that. And also, you gentlemen, I mean, I'm sort of leading the tour. You're going to be at the receiving end. Of course, listeners might have seen our newsletter that went out last week. We invited people to join us. We've chartered a jazzy little Pilatus, which is going to fly people down to Lido Airport. So I'm taking them. You're going to be there greeting them. But maybe tell us about the newspaper first. What can we expect? Because that's also going to be sort of the key highlights of what's going to be happening this year.
Yeah, I mean, working very closely with the one and only Nolan Giles, who also has assured me I'm going to get the big bedroom at the apartment we're staying in. I just wanted to get that on air. No, but I mean, we're talking to everyone from Hashim Sarkis, who's the curator for the architecture Biennale. We had a really, really great chat with him just about, I guess, the importance of this. And I think, and again, the reason I'm going on about this is because it's probably my favorite interview in the paper. But just talking about the importance of obviously coming together and having all these.
That is just for those who might have missed. That is the theme this year as well.
That is how will we live together? And funnily enough, they actually chose that in 2018 or 2019 rather, well before the events of 2020 took place. So speaking to Hashim about the importance of coming together, but also a number of the curators and architects participating, and to add, I guess, to the fact that this theme was chosen in 2019 is the fact that a lot of I think almost all of the architects have continued with their original plans. They haven't felt the need to respond, I guess, to the pandemic, because the issues that they were addressing or looking to unpack were pertinent then, and they'll continue to be pertinent in the future.
Nolan, and that's maybe a good point, because this also probably should be a look ahead platform, shouldn't it? Because yes, there's been enough looking back now. So do you see this also a bit of a forwarding moment, not just for the architecture and design industry, a little bit for the world in general?
For sure. I mean, in terms of an event, it's something looking forward. We're all going to be there. We're going to be back in person. It's exciting, and I think the vibe's going to be very good. In terms of what's on display, as Nick was saying, a lot hasn't changed in what these people are offering. And I mean, I spoke to an architect in the UK called Alison Brooks. Her whole exhibition looks at the foyer space of housing. Basically, you know, so many apartments have crappy foyers where there's not much happening. It's all this dead space that could be reused in the city. There's lots of good ideas about designing better cities, about designing better homes. And, you know, in this moment when we are looking to get back out into the world, looking for new ideas, this is the place to get them.
Just maybe from each of you, I'll start with you, Nick, a little bit of a highlight. If there's sort of three things you're looking forward to as soon as you touch down in Venice on Wednesday, what are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm looking forward to opening the paper. So that's not going to be on Wednesday. That's going to be on Saturday. I'm looking forward to
I think if you behave, there'll be copies.
I get a little preview.
Friday afternoon for sure. Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to particularly the story, obviously, of you flying into the airport. That's going to be in there. I'm particularly excited about the Catalonian Pavilion, which I've discussed with you previously, both of you previously. That's also going to be in the paper. It's basically trying to merge data on air pollution with an artistic installation.
So you've already lost a lot of listeners now. I hear people switching off the radios.
I'm really trying to work on my elevator pitch for this one. Okay. And then I think just last...
I think delete the word data.
Okay, data.
Or see, data.
But this is... Now I feel like I'm getting roasted for my accent. I can't help that, Tyler. And then I guess lastly, just being in Venice, it's been a while since I've been there, and obviously I haven't been able to go back. So very excited.
Nolan?
Well, I am particularly keen to see the Korean Pavilion. I have a few connections to that country and I love it, but I think what they're doing is all around architecture, education, bringing design and good ideas about design to the world in this kind of giant, weird classroom setup they have on their pavilion. And then also just being in the Arsenale, which is the kind of, it's almost like a giant museum just filled with installations, and a lot of, I guess, lesser known architects are able to show their work to the rest of the world, and just wandering around there for a couple of days, you get so many great ideas and so much inspiration. So I'm really excited to just get lost in there for a few days, and maybe your guests will get lost with me too, Tyler.
Could be. Gentlemen, we'll probably be checking in with you, I'm sure, on Wednesday or Thursday. We need to be getting our money's worth out of this little assignment down that way. Nick Moniz, Nolan Giles, thank you very much. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Just gone 13:26, almost 13:27 here in Zurich. We're probably going to run over a few minutes because we're going to cross to London now, where Monocle's Eurovision desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is standing by in eager anticipation of the first of the competition's semi-finals. Good afternoon, Fernando.
Good afternoon, Tyler. As you can imagine, I'm quite excited after we had a year break of Eurovision. That's quite unusual, so I think that makes it for an extra special year.
So we're heading to Rotterdam. This means, of course, that people are taking to the stage right now. There are the finals. There will be a series of countries which get knocked out, deservedly. Of course, for the big night coming up on Saturday. So there's a couple of, songs that are out there. They're maybe not the most joyous numbers, at least one of them I can think of. But nevertheless, you know, there's occasionally some quirky twists and turns that happen at Eurovision. I know you've got two for us today.
Absolutely. Well, today's first semifinal, I have to say, is the stronger one, much stronger than the second one, which will happen on Thursday. I mean, Lithuania is competing today. I know it's one of your favorites as well, Tyler, which I love. We've been playing here on the playlist as well. We have Norway, Israel, Malta. But one track that I would like to pay attention, it's something that actually I didn't even realize that it would be one of the favorites, but it's climbing up the charts according to the bookies. It's the entry from Cyprus. Her name is Elena Tsagrinou, and the song's called El Diablo. It's causing so much controversy there in Cyprus because some people think, you know, she's doing satanic worship, and she said that's definitely not the case. But the song is quite fun. Shall we have a listen, Tyler?
Let's do.
I'm
I think that might work on stage. She's wearing skin-tight costumes. I can see why perhaps the Orthodox Church in Cyprus was a bit bothered by her song and performance as well.
Yeah, I'm sure there's definitely going to be some fireworks behind her. I can already see what that might look like. We want to go to France now, though. This is an interesting one because I've been with people when they've heard it. It doesn't sort of grab them right away, but by the end of the song, people are sort of thinking, there's something in this.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, Tyler. It's not really my thing, kind of ballads on Eurovision. But, you know, it's one of the favorite songs to win this year. It's very restrained. Her name is Barbara Pravi, and I have a little trivia for you. You know, she did the soundtrack for the Swiss film, the live-action version of Heidi, back in 2015. So, you know, she also has some kind of Swiss connections there. As I said, you know, it's not El Diablo, you know what I mean? But, you know, it's a beautiful song. Let's have a listen. It's Barbara Pravi with Voilà. It's a powerful song. And Tyler, I gotta be honest with you. I'm very surprised about the songs that are considered favorite this year, because not only the French entry, the Italian entry, which, I mean, we're not going to play a clip. I don't think you will like it, actually. It's quite rock and roll. It's by Maneskin, Zitti e Buoni. But it's receiving a lot of love for some reason. I wonder if people want something a bit different. Again, it's a very surprising year. We don't know who's going to win.
No, it'll be interesting viewing. I imagine, Fernando, we haven't discussed it yet, but I think there's going to be obviously a big recap on Sunday morning on Monocle on Sunday. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our Eurovision desk editor, we are going to have to leave it there. We'll be chatting later in the week. That's all the time we have for today's program. The briefing was produced by Rhys James and Emma Cirillo, studio manager back in London, Christy Evans. We'll be back at the very same time tomorrow. That's 1300. If you're listening on the continent, midday in London, I'm Tyler Brulé. Have a good afternoon. Goodbye.